Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
The United States and South Korea reach a deal on nuclear weapons, plus fresh signs of U.S. banking trouble, and what lower prices? Consumer goods companies post strong earnings as shoppers continue paying up.
Brands are still powerful. Consumers are broadly still choosing brand names they know and trust, but there is the fear of a tipping point.
It's Wednesday, April 26th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin today with an exclusive report that the U.S. and South Korea have agreed to a major nuclear weapons deal that will give Seoul a greater say in the potential use of nuclear weapons in a conflict with North Korea. The Wall Street Journal's Deputy World Coverage Chief Brendan Moran has been tracking this story and joins me now from Singapore. Brendan, this agreement, it's being called the Washington Declaration, which sounds consequential. I mean, break it down for us. What is so significant about this?
So we've got the South Korean President Yoon in Washington this week for a state visit. Today they're holding a summit, and at the end of that summit, we've got a report out from our national security team in Washington reporting that at the end of that summit, they're going to unveil the text of something they're calling the Washington Declaration, which will, well, it doesn't sound like it's going to put South Korea's finger on the proverbial button. It'll get them a little bit closer to that. It sounds like they're going to basically be working a little bit closer in consultation with U.S. officials. They've always worked closely together and had a close alliance. But as anxieties have grown about the North Korean nuclear and missile threat, they've increasingly wanted a bigger role in what's called extended deterrence. This is the notion that the U.S. would use its nuclear arsenal to defend South Korea in the event that it's attacked by North Korea, even if that meant bringing about a response from North Korea on the U.S. And, you know, essentially it provides South Korea with more reassurance that they've got a seat at the table in the event that they're attacked.
Got it. So is that the real significance here? The U.S. basically signaling to South Korea, don't worry, our commitment to protect you is not going to weaken in any way?
Yeah, I mean, symbolism is a big part of this. And I don't think that's necessarily because there were significant doubts about the U.S. commitment to South Korea. There's been, you know, through various administrations, there have been ups and downs in that relationship, but the U.S. and South Korea have remained close allies. But we've hit this period where I think anxieties have grown because as of about a couple of years ago, North Korea really started to ramp up its weapons testing. And we saw last year, we saw a record number of missile tests. You've got Kim Jong-un vowing to expand his nuclear arsenal exponentially. And understandably, if you're sitting in South Korea, that's going to make you increasingly uncomfortable. We saw in January, the South Korean President Yoon come out and for the first time in decades float the possibility that South Korea could even develop its own nuclear weapons or ask the U.S. to station some nuclear, strategic nuclear assets on the peninsula. The U.S. used to have, decades ago, nuclear weapons on the Korean peninsula, but withdrew them at the end of the Cold War. And ever since then, they've had a centerpiece of U.S. policy has been to try to denuclearize the Korean peninsula. So the U.S. didn't want that. And so now they're providing this. This is an effort on the U.S.'s part to signal to them that we don't need to go down that route. We've got your back. We'll support you in a crisis.
That was Wall Street Journal Deputy World Coverage Chief Brendan Moran joining me from Singapore. Now to fresh signs of potential trouble in the U.S. banking sector. Shares of regional lender First Republic Bank plummeted by nearly 50% yesterday, a day after the bank disclosed it had lost around $100 billion in deposits last month. That has again raised concern over the health of regional U.S. banks after weeks of relative calm. But just how worried should investors be? Wall Street Journal Deputy Europe Finance Editor Quinton Webb is here with me now in London with the details. Quinton, we're recording this just a few hours before U.S. markets open, and investors, I'm sure, will be concerned today whether the issues at First Republic look isolated, do they?
Well, to some extent, they do. There are no other regional banks whose shares are selling off like this. And many of the larger regional banks actually reported relatively robust results recently. So there is a sense in which the problems at First Republic seem confined to that bank. But, you know, there is also a concern, I suppose, that as the sector looks to get its house in order, one of the probable implications is that many of these banks will pull back some of their lending. And so you could see tighter credit conditions, which is generally not good for economic growth.
What should we be watching for as this story plays out? Is it going to be troubleshooting within First Republic about how to navigate these issues? Is it going to be whether policymakers in D.C. raise an alarm? What should we be watching?
It's important to look for signs of market stress, so signs that investors are losing confidence in other banks. If share prices start to fall or credit default swap prices start to surge, it's interesting to look at what First Republic will do next. They have a funding problem now where effectively they're relying on rather expensive funding because they've seen this big deposit loss. And so they have low yielding assets and expensive funding. So how do they get out of this predicament? And yes, will there be more from the regulators? We heard yesterday from the chief of staff in the White House saying that this is something that regulators are watching closely and that overall, you know, deposits across the system have stabilized and the system as a whole is sound and resilient. So it's sort of attempting to strike this calming tone. But of course, if Secretary Yellen or Chair Powell at the Federal Reserve say more, that will be watched very closely by investors.
That was Wall Street Journal Deputy Europe Finance Editor Quinton Webb. Quinton, thank you as always.
Thanks very much.
And coming up, it's a bumper earnings week with results from big consumer goods companies giving us a window into how rising prices are affecting consumers and what that reveals about the state of the economy. That story after the break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Earnings season is far from over for some of the world's largest consumer goods companies. Colgate-Palmolive, Unilever, Cisco, InBev, and Mondelez, among others, have yet to open up their books. But we now have enough data to conclude that, broadly speaking, shoppers who are looking for price breaks on basic products are going to have to wait. That's because, at least for now, companies are the ones that seem to have pricing power on their side. And Journal reporter Heather Haddon joins me now from Chicago with a look at just how long consumers will continue to stomach those higher prices. Heather, as consumers, most of us, I think, know the things that we've been buying have been getting more expensive, but it can be hard to see just how much more things actually cost. You've been listening in on earnings calls. What are companies saying about this?
Yeah, companies broadly have raised prices, and a lot of them say they might need to continue to do that to absorb higher costs. So higher costs for labor, higher costs for ingredients. So McDonald's said that they raised prices during the quarter in the U.S. PepsiCo said it raised prices about 13% in its latest quarter. Kimberly-Clark, which makes diapers and tissue, said it also raised its prices by 10%. And Nestle also said it raises prices nearly 10%. That's year over year. So those are substantial price increases on the backs of what has been steady price increases from a lot of companies.
All right. So that's got to affect consumer demand at some point, right? When everybody's hitting 10%+, I mean, that raises the cost of a basket of goods by a lot.
Well, the retail data shows that retail spending is slowing, but consumers do have a lot of savings still that they are tapping into to be able to spend money. That said, I would say a lot of companies are very cognizant that they can't raise prices forever. You know, McDonald's said that they are closely watching the impact of their price increases on customers, and they have started to see a little bit of resistance as they have raised prices. So whether that's customers buying a few less servings of fries or maybe just, you know, a smaller order, the company is seeing that and closely monitoring it. They don't want to scare away customers.
Okay, so maybe more consumers opting for a medium fry instead of a large fry at McDonald's. But broadly speaking, whether we're looking at results from Kimberly-Clark, Procter & Gamble, Nestle, major consumer goods companies, they're saying sales are still pretty healthy. That's got to be a welcome observation that consumers really haven't been put off by price hikes so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think companies are pleased that the price increases haven't scared people off in droves. And that brands are still powerful. Consumers are broadly still choosing brand names they know and trust during these times to spend with. But there is the fear of a tipping point of scaring people away. So a lot of companies are closely monitoring this, especially with lower income consumers who feel this first.
Is this changing pricing strategies going forward? I know companies don't need to commit to those price hikes or way out into the future, but are we seeing signs instead of price hikes, companies might be opting more for kind of keeping things where they are?
There is some signs that they are moderating, at least how often they're taking these price increases. You know, a lot of companies traditionally before all this would take price increases maybe like twice a year. Last year, companies were taking half a dozen price increases. And I think a lot of companies don't want to do that again. They want to moderate the price increases, you know, make them less frequent. Conagra, which makes Hunt's ketchup and Slim Jim meat sticks, said earlier this year that it was done boosting prices after it experienced some sale volumes drops. Corona bestseller Constellation Brands said it would slow pricing increases after sales growth slowed. So I think companies are being more mindful about these price increases and how they're impacting consumers.
What is it on the consumer health front that businesses are most concerned about? Is it layoffs or maybe the savings that people seem to be gradually drawing down?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have the stimulus payments that we did earlier in the pandemic. I think tax returns are also looking to individuals not quite as robust as we've had in previous years. So people are getting less money that way. And yeah, I mean, the layoffs are meaningful. People are starting to be a little more cautious with their spending. I mean, we have benefited from gas prices falling in the U.S. That has been a benefit here. But where I am in Chicago, that has slowed. So the gas prices are actually increasing now. So there's a lot of inputs for families that aren't necessarily getting better right now.
Finally, Heather, as the Fed continues to try and cool economic activity to bring down inflation, I would imagine a big question for consumer goods companies is going to be, which of our products do people keep buying and which do they stop buying? Do we know where consumers might be drawing that line?
Yeah, so the March federal data from the Commerce Department already showed that consumers are paring back on their spending on higher cost items, such as vehicles, appliances, and furniture, you know, big ticket items that might just be more difficult to buy right now. But, you know, if you look at the restaurant data, it was basically just up slightly. Like, people are still spending for affordable luxuries. So going out to a restaurant, people might be doing, whereas buying a new Whirlpool appliance, they might not be.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon in Chicago. Heather, thanks for the update.
Thanks so much.
And in other stories moving the world today, senators are set to introduce bipartisan legislation today forcing the U.S. Supreme Court to create a code of ethics that follows media reports that raise questions about whether two justices, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, properly disclosed financial activities. The bill would task the court with creating its own conduct rules within a year, and the bill's backers hope its sponsorship by Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, a Republican, increases its odds of passage in a divided Congress. Other federal judges are already subject to a code of conduct. We now have more details about what contributed to anchor Tucker Carlson's firing from Fox News earlier this week. According to people familiar with the matter, Carlson sent private messages where he showed disregard for management and colleagues, including one message in which he called a senior Fox News executive the C-word. Those messages were reportedly a major factor in the decision to oust the star host on Monday. The private messages were part of a trove of emails and texts from Fox executives and hosts that were made public as part of a Dominion Voting System's defamation lawsuit against Fox News. Tucker Carlson declined to comment on his departure. And we should note that Fox News parent Fox Corp and Wall Street Journal parent News Corp share common ownership. U.S. officials say that Russian military actions in Syria are raising the risk of an escalation between the two military superpowers. Over the past 2 months, armed Russian warplanes in the skies over Syria have repeatedly flown dangerously close to American jet fighters and over U.S. ground forces that are working in the country. According to American officials, that is creating new risks for deadly miscalculation between Russian and American forces, who have maintained an uneasy arrangement in Syria for nearly a decade, supporting opposite sides of the ongoing Syrian civil war. U.S. Air Force's Central Command says that Moscow has rejected complaints about Russian military action, with the Russian military insisting it has the right to carry out operations in Syria. The Russian Defense Ministry didn't respond to a request for comment. And we are reporting that retailer Gap is cutting hundreds of corporate jobs from its global workforce as part of a broad restructuring. According to people familiar with the situation, the cuts are expected to be larger than ones in September, when Gap got rid of roughly 500 corporate positions. In March, Gap said it identified an additional $300 million in cost cuts, including by stripping out layers of management. And finally, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is an 80,000-ton cloud of plastic and trash that can be found floating a 5 days boat ride off the coast of California. It is an environmental disaster, but it's also teeming with life, as scientists have found that species from barnacles to anemones that are usually found on the coast are clinging to trash in the open sea. And Wall Street Journal science reporter Nidhi Subbaraman spoke to scientists about what that finding means for those species.
What they did see was that they had kind of adapted themselves to this weird new habitat that was partly man-made. These anemones that usually have grains of sand in their mouths now had pieces of these tiny grains of plastic lodged where once there would have been sand. And so they were, they'd basically just taken over this new landscape and somehow managed to make a go of it. There are consequences to what we put in the ocean, and it's not yet clear what those are, because now if we take the plastic out, it seems like we're going to be disturbing the newfound homes of these organisms that have managed to take root here. So one of the researchers I spoke to, Rebecca Helm at Georgetown University, she said, well, I don't quite think the takeaway is that we can't take out the plastic. I think we need to think more carefully about how much we put in, because it's going to have this sort of domino effect on species that we can't even think about.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.